Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Well, hello, you beautiful people.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me. Holiday Bryce.
Holiday here. Bryce.
Wow. Oh, my God. A lot's changed.
That's right.
Holiday Bryce.
He's the jauntiest bounty hunter on the whole roster. Oh, man. If I'm going to get taken down by anyone, I'm glad it's Holiday Bryce. What? A gift for me? Aw, yeah, it is the dead. Festival of Lights.
Oh, wow. Deadly.
Pumpkin bites.
That's right. Hi, everybody.
Gentlemen, here we are. One more day in 2019. And however you want to count, defining it as the... What was this decade? The teens? What was this decade? Which... What are we calling it?
Yeah, I guess it took us 10 years, but in 2019, I finally got comfortable with calling it the aughts without rolling my eyes or saying the turn of the century without thinking I'm putting on airs. But the teens, I'm down with the teens.
I was all about the aughts. I was on the aughts early. I really like calling it the aughts because it's something that is so rarely said. Right, in our common vernacular that is usually focused on the last few decades. But
what about 2020? Are you a linguistic purist? Can you handle the idea of calling it the 2010s? Because that's probably what I'll do.
Gun to my head, tell me what the decade was. I'd probably say either colloquially, I'd probably say the 2010s. I'd cast my vote for the 10s. I don't know about the teens, though.
It felt right when I said it the first time, but the more I think about it, I think I would, at a gut level, call it the 2000s, the 10s, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s.
You want to hear a weird one that I just found? So this is csmonitor.com. An Australian competition came up with the name The Wonders.
The Oneaters.
I wonder what happened to the Oneaters.
So we're all in agreement that like this, the 2019 was the last year of the decade.
If we're getting into the whole, it's funny because, you know, my kids are, they've never been conscious for this debate. And we had it about as hard as you were going to have it at the end of the millennium. Or was it the millennium ending? Was it 2000 or 2001? And it's like, that's the loudest that dumb debate got. And the hardest, that's when I calcified and decided it's the time when the odometer flips. That's the best way to, who cares?
Well, and beyond that, functionally, this is a holiday and a celebration defined by a party and a gathering, right? So where is the biggest party and gathering going to be?
Is it
going to
be in 2000 or 2001?
Yeah, or similarly, is it going to be in the New Year's Eve between 2019 and 2020 or 2020 and 2021? And absolutely, the more fun party is going to be the one that happened in 1999. Prince made a song about it, and the one that's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, in our imaginary calendar that starts with the first year and not several hundred years later, we go back, it would be like, well, okay, this would be year one, not year zero. Right. So, you know, the year would have the first year of the of the century, the decade or millennium would have a one in it. Wait, all right. I may have talked myself out of it now.
Well, I mean, so there's the argument is there's no year zero, right?
Right.
That is the rallying cry of this is not the end of the decade or millennium people, to which I say, prove it.
Yeah.
Go on. Well, find me definitive proof that at some point somebody wasn't like, either this is year zero or probably more commonly, oh, remember that year before one? Yeah, that was zero. And also I have a little thing up my sleeve in case you want to say no on both. I'm retroactively declaring that there was a year zero. So
well, also, it'd feel weird to talk about the 90s and mention, you know, back in 2000, you know, the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah. Hey, so, you know what? You just settled the debate. Anybody who wants to tell you that this is not the end of the decade, you're like, oh, great. So so that means that 2000 was in the 90s? And then just patiently wait for them to be cool with that, which they won't. And then it's over with.
Yeah. There we go. It's been settled.
Man, that was actually, that is the single most powerful shutdown of that argument that I've heard. That's amazing.
Well, I'll do the, well, you see, because the 90s is different than the decade, and I don't know. Let's just, 220, guys!
Hey, man, you want to time travel through nostalgia and think about all the things that have changed since, you know, 10 years ago this very day?
Like I do every time I pick up the remote control.
what do you mean? Just like everybody
understand these things. Oh, I'm sorry.
What is the most defining technology of the tens? What is the when we look back?
It is. I'll tell you what. Let me start with what it's not. It is definitely not anything smartphone related. Like functionally speaking. Tell me there's anything different about your smartphone today versus 10 years ago. Like it's a thing you hold in your hand that you touch with your fingers that connects you to other people that does emails and pictures. And what is it now? All those things. Nothing. Yeah, like,
Andrew, you go, because I'm going to look something up.
I agree that the device, Brian, is just, it's a bigger, faster. And I think we probably talked about that. What are we going to look forward to in the iPhone in 10 years? And I think we probably said, I think we said thinner too, which no, but I think the biggest thing is the, with all computers, the really thing is what the software does. And, you know, as we reach the end of this decade and you look at my niece was at the shopping mall. We were in Florida and my niece was at a shopping mall and she looks over and she says to my brother, she says, Dad, that's so-and-so, this family from YouTube. Can I go say hi? And it was a super famous YouTube family that saw them all. And they went over and said, hi, they're super nice people, all that. When they sit, my nieces sit in front of the TV, they pull up YouTube. And that's what they watch, is they watch their favorite YouTube shows. Their stars are YouTube stars. Maybe be some Disney, but it could be just as easily open up YouTube and watch this stuff. You know, the littlest one, since she's 6 or 7, she knows that she's got her favorite. YouTube existed 10 years ago, but it was back that sort of niche sort of thing. And now, you know, we're entering this decade where you look at the biggest stars are people like Billie Eilish, you know, and other people who have made their name by SoundCloud. And really, we saw the dream of the 2000s with social media and whatnot come kind of be realized, and how your phone has become this nexus for all of this.
Can I conduct an experiment right now? I have a 12-year-old daughter. I could call her on the phone right now, and I can ask her to name however many of the 5 big broadcast networks, and I'm being generous because I'm going to include the CW in this.
The CW?
Well, yeah, it would be NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, and CW. Is there anybody else in the, I guess PBS maybe.
CW is not cable?
No. Oh, you didn't know that. That's amazing. CW used to be, get this, this is how old we are, UPN and UPN. The WB. And then they combined to be the CW.
Yeah, the WB. Yeah. I remember we watched The Simpsons on the WB. And he's dialing the phone.
So here we go. Brian, while you do this, I have without a doubt the winner here.
Oh, of what defines? Oh, hey, Josie.
Fine.
Sweetie, you're live on the internet. Dozens of people are hearing you. Yes. Okay. But here's the thing. Television, right? You know that there are TV stations, right?
Yes.
And you know that some are on cable and some are broadcast over the airwaves, right?
Yes.
Okay. How many, when I was your age, there were 3 big cable network or big broadcast channels, and then they added a 4th. How many of those can you name?
I don't know.
Can you name any TV channels?
Any channels
that come over the
Disney
air.
Or something?
Well, Disney would be a cable channel. They do have a cable channel. How many?
I don't pay attention to this stuff.
Okay, but can you name, like, what's the biggest If you were to guess, what's the biggest TV channel there is?
Broadcast. Yeah.
I don't know why.
Because we're talking about how different it is to be an old person like us versus a young person like you. What TV channel has Saturday Night Live on it? Have you ever heard of Saturday Night Live?
I think we've got.
I kind of know what you're talking about. Like.
Okay. All right. I love you. Bye.
Hey, Brian. Hey, Grandpa. What radio station network has the Lawrence Welk show?
Yeah. Can I still get the Colgate Hour on this TV, or do I have to get an RF adapter?
Oh, it's so amazing to me.
Hey, what station is Fibber McGee and Molly on, Brian?
Oh, gotta get home. I'm about to miss Beaver.
The most popular show of its day, Amos and Andy. Okay.
Yeah.
What channel?
Oh my God.
What channel was Amos and Andy on? CBS?
One that would surely have to apologize in 2019 is the answer to that. All right, here we go. Are you ready for it?
Yep.
This is I will go all in on this. The technology that the tens will be reminded for, and this is where I will directly contradict Brian Brushwood. What is different from your cell phone comparatively? 2011. The launch of Siri on the iPhone. I think that voice technology writ large, right, will be the thing that we look back on and say this was the defining thing. Because tell you what, I was visiting family in Orlando, visiting family in Ohio. Everybody, a gift that we got to everybody were Amazon-enabled voice devices. Every single one of those kids that were toddlers the last time I saw them and now all talk, they all interact. That is universally the first computer that they interact with. They are more comfortable with that than anything else because they don't know how to type. They don't have their own devices. They barely, before they even know how to spell, they know how to talk to these devices. I think that that will be, no matter what, the thing, the technological legacy of this decade.
Yeah, I would say, I guess just globally speaking, because that's detached from the cell phone. I guess it's just the digital assistant, the voice activated assistant.
Eventually, it got detached from the cell phone, but it began there, at least officially as part of the core iOS in 2011. Although it was, I think, pre 2010, its own app.
Yeah. 10 years ago, not that I want to guide us into our crack cocaine that we can't let go of, but had SpaceX landed its first stages yet 10 years ago?
No. I actually found an article. Was like, they're 7 years ago was when they were watching Grasshopper test.
Wow. Yeah. And I guess self-driving cars, Teslas for the masses, none of that happened.
Yeah. The Model S like started shipping in bulk in 2011 or something. I'd have to pull that up, but I'm just pulling up the Grasshopper. That was the Grasshopper was what SpaceX called the test stage that they used to figure out if it would work. The program for testing that began in 2012, and then,
by the way, here, while you look that up, I just got an updated text from Josie saying, wait, like NBC or something? I don't know. Or Fox? I'm just naming things.
She's good.
Yep, she got it.
That was the game.
She got there.
I bet she Googled 2012 it. Was when they had the first test of the grass. And that's a pretty amazing achievement to think that we went from 7 years ago to now, and it's a normal thing. I think that's one of the things that sort of overall, just a step away from the phone, that struck me was how quickly certain things can happen in technology when the right team and the right focus is on it.
Even more impressive than that first time they landed the first stage. Like, I will remember where I was when I saw two of those first stages I forget which one's called what. Big rocket. Land simultaneously. That was amazing. Falcon Heavy. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. The Model S started shipping in 2012. So I would say that's a big difference too, is it like, you know, we had Priuses everywhere. You know, Prius is a super popular car, but for fully electric, you know, other than if you may have seen like a Chevy Volt back in the day, you know, now in LA, it's normal. If I go stand on the corner and wait long enough, I will see Tesla passing by, you know, in California. And I've seen that more elsewhere. So.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, my neighborhood, which has a staggeringly high number of window break-ins, still you can see Teslas being parked on the street because people really want to own Teslas, even if they might get their windows broken in.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that that is a huge huge factor. I mean, and really what I think the tens will largely be remembered for is. The aughts saw the shattering of the monoculture, and the tens saw the beginning of like the fiefdoms and what, but is both good and bad of what could come from that, including companies that just kind of came out of nowhere, you know, that would happen, you know, with even bigger results than could have been happened before.
Yeah, I've been thinking about you know, we've talked about the shattering of the monoculture before, but I suspect that we might be seeing kind of a reassembly of it because my kids don't know where these movies come from that the memes that they know originated. But they know that they're universally spoken throughout all of their communities, and whether it's in their highly fragmented Discord environments or in the more universal Reddit type environment, I don't know. I get the vibe that we're sort of recoalescing, much like you know, Earth after getting smashed by the planetoid that became the moon. I feel like everything's reassembling.
I think that now our fiefdoms feel more like a monoculture because the population is up. And there are certainly elements of, you know, the current generation has a tremendous appreciation for the past in a way that I think even us growing up could have never really understood, because you got all these kids that, I mean, like, ask yourself, why is Friends or anything with these gigantic back catalogs going for the kind of streaming rights fees that they are getting? And the answer is, Kids go through everything that they want to watch on Netflix and Hulu and now Disney Plus, and they are just there for more stuff. And so now what looks exciting? Well, not this 6-episode peak television thing that we were all super excited for because we were tired of the deluge of 23 episodes of a comedy series where barely anything happens. They just want content. And so now Friends, built in this era where it's a 30-minute comedy show that they made 25 to 30 episodes a season of, that's the kind of meal that they really want to enjoy. They want to sit down and soak into this a different era of comedy. And that's fascinating.
I'll tell you what, man. There's a value to beige. There's a value to beige. There's like, we want something that everybody in the family can agree is pretty good, and we all like it for different reasons. And, you know, right now we're having a blast going through the back catalog of finally watching Parks and Recreation. And it's the one show that our whole family gathers together in one room to sit and watch, you know, 4 or 5 episodes at a time.
I mean, think about Everybody Loves Raymond. That was the same thing. It was just a later in that wave, but I think that will probably find its way somewhere too in a similarly big. I mean, Everybody Loves the reruns of that show did insanely well on TV.
Oh yeah.
So they talk about that as like four quadrant, like hitting all four quadrants and things like that, that do that, you know, before it always will probably like Stranger Things will resonate, you know, with everybody.
Yeah. But the four quadrants being young, old, boy, girl. So yeah. if you can appeal to young, old, across the gender gap, then that's your like big money.
You know, it's watching Mandalorian, and my niece hadn't seen it yet. My niece is like 7 years old, and it's funny is the opening starts, and then she turns to my brother, her dad, and goes, "What's with the intro?" Because it was so short. Yeah. 7-year-olds commenting on the intro. What's with the intro? Like, oh, geez.
You know, by the way, that intro that plays before Every episode of Mandalorian, you see, you know, lights going around, you know, you see a droid yeah. face, you see a stormtrooper face, you see a Vader face and all that stuff. And I just remember, I think I've only gotten John to watch just the first couple of episodes. But like, as that's happening, he says, ah, yes, Disney leaning fully in to their ability to make people identify with characters to which they don't have to ever pay royalties because like that's why they put everybody in a mask is because you don't have to pay residuals to a mask.
Well, yeah, I mean, they do buyouts. That's why they do action figure stuff like that. But also it's like, you know, it's easier to you merchandise the thing that you're not worried about, you know, showing up in a scandal, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, don't speak too soon. We are not. I would not be shocked if our 20s, the Roaring 20s, includes this, you know, cocaine and booze fueled BB-8 scandal.
Oh, I got to show you in Orlando, where they're pushing Galaxy's Edge really hard. They had a big push for Star Wars: The Rise of Galaxy's Edge. And this is when you go to get on the train. This is in the shuttle at the airport. This is what you see.
A bunch of stormtroopers with First Order banners.
Space Nazis. Welcome.
Yeah. And I'm like literally going, they're called stormtroopers because, you know, stormtroopers and trains are not a connection that I would want to make in anybody's head.
Oh, that's terrible. I should stop laughing.
Run on time, though.
Yeah. I'm like, where is this going? Where is this train going?
I mean, I've always had a very confused. I've just stood there with my mouth agape as Disney just increasingly leans in on the merchandising rights to, you know, the galaxy's greatest murderers. They're genocide machines, and I'm just like, okay.
I mean, look, dude. Whatever sells, they're there for. You know, they're going to look at that spreadsheet and they're going to see who's moving units and they're going to be more of them.
I was very curious. I just thought I'd pull up my mail and see if I could like pull up something from like 2010, you know, just to see like some app stuff I was working on. Shocker. let's see, like literally.
Where was your literary career back in 2010?
Non-existent.
Wait, you hadn't even begun? I thought you had started writing by then. No, I guess not. Yeah. Because we were only like a year into NSFW when you started doing novellas and stuff. So you're saying everything that has happened. Guys, I'm starting to think that a lot can happen in 10 years.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah. When was Grendel's Shadow published March 25th? 2011. So you weren't far away.
I like that he just fact checked me. I'm like, no, it wasn't until a year later. Like, no, we're gonna check you, sir.
I'm curious because I remember this very vividly. It was on a plane ride back to Florida, to South Florida from Austin. We did
sitting at the airport. Yeah,
we did a South by Southwest, and then. You know, you started sketching out. I think you even showed me the beginnings of it on the plane, if I remember correctly. But then you finished it really quick because this is not far away from South by that year. I mean, it might have been a week and a half later that it went up.
So the one I pull up one thing. Let me see if I can go full screen on this. One thing to see, like, oh, what's in my email? And I see a thing that says album big, and this is what it is. This is from literally 10 years ago today.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, the Weird Things logo.
I believe still the current album art.
It's a little different than that, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, me holding, you know, 10 years of me holding that stupid machete the wrong way.
It's okay. I'm sure my candle's burned out. I would say that, so we've talked about things that obviously the bigger sort of changes. So I'd say voice assistance was a big thing. I think that, you know, certainly like we said, for areas we are seeing usable electric cars that you would average person might want, I think has been a big change. Reusable rockets. So a decade gave us voice assistance, reusable rockets, electric cars. the awareness from other people that social media has, you know, a double-edged, you know.
Yeah, you know, that was really, I mean, if you look at the stories that were being written about Facebook, and let's draw a tight circle around politics for the time being, but the stories written about Facebook in 2010 versus the ones that will be written in 3 days in 2020, it was largely about, you know, in politics, it was what an amazing data acquisition tool it was, and how this was the future of politics, and how the Obama reelection campaign was going to unveil the highest you know, the attention to detail on exactly which house in a neighborhood. I need to find these articles, but I remember specifically one of them saying that they would be able to tell the house in the neighborhood that if they were able to change their mind to put a sign out on their front door, they would be able to, or on their front lawn, they'd be able to flip the neighborhood statistically. Now, I don't know how much of that was real, how much of that was just kind of spin being told to political reporters who were definitely not tech reporters. But, you know, compare that to I mean, I think we're at two congressional appearances by Mark Zuckerberg, and I doubt that he will escape this decade without seeing at least three or four more. This is definitely a different world.
Yeah, they didn't have their IPO till 2012.
Wow. Yeah, and this was, I mean, wow, 2010. We're still at, you know, the beginning of, yeah, that was still a, I mean, we were closer to, like, you know, the, remember beer diplomacy?
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. I'll tell you what. In fact, I just went back and I found this gem from October 2009. So I guess what, a month and, or sorry, 2 months and 10 years ago, we got our first comment on the Weird Things podcast. Rabbit Hussein Badger wrote, "This was an awesome first episode. Smart, funny, and well-structured. Andrew is an awesome, well-prepared host and seems to be the only human on Earth able to contain Brian and Justin to a large extent." And how much has changed? That's also 10 years ago we did the Houdini seance. If anybody was tuned in live for that, we definitely factually shoved our success right in the face of James Randi as we contacted the delightful spirit of Houdini.
You know, I know we kind of talked about phones a little bit as maybe not having changed much in terms of offering in the past 10 years, but phones and also tablets have really become new. Alternatives are not the right word, but new ways of doing things that you would do on, say, a full computer, mm-hmm. a laptop, a desktop, or something, and bring the price and availability of those tools down. You know, an iPad is cheaper than you know, some so-so laptops, and you can probably get as much done on it with different software. But
tell you what, man, my 15-year-old, no interest in, she has multiple laptops, no interest in any of them. She will lose her mind if I take away her iPad. Like, even though she can access all the same groups and do the same work and do the same everything, yeah. It's the iPad is special in a way that that the computers are not.
I mean, that is one thing that definitely, you know, futurists at this time a decade ago, certainly at Google, were very, very bullish on the idea of everything being accessed from the internet. Right. And that's what the future would be, is less and less hardware, less and less computing power locally, more and more computing power in the cloud. And that the physical thing that you would need would therefore be able to be lighter and cheaper. Indeed, trend wise, that happened. I don't know if it quite happened as fast as Google maybe would have wanted it to happen. And I think we're still probably another few years away. We are at least ubiquitous, super fast internet away from it being something that everybody like kind of hits, I think, a tipping point in terms of a mass scale. But certainly the trend lines are there, you know, and that's, I think, a lot of the reason why tablets have become more and more functional is that now the pain of changing devices is so much less because so much of what we do every single day is in the cloud.
Yeah, it's just, in our sense, you know, that's one of those devices. It's such an everyday part of what I do. Most of my computing is probably on my iPad. And I think like, yeah, that was here was April 2010 when that was introduced and how much that's taken over. And, you know, when I travel, I'll bring a little Fire tablet, one of the Amazon, like they're like $50 because it has built-in Alexa. And so if I just want to listen to my audiobooks or whatever, I just use that as an alarm clock, whatever, plug it in. You know, for $50, it's a great little travel thing. You know, and that's the thing that I think that, you know, I have the latest model iPad, which I love, which is great and it's worth it. But I also have one of these little cheap tablets because there are certain things where I just sort of, if I need a computer to do a thing and doesn't have to be smart about it, I'll just use one of those.
Yeah.
No. But yeah, I think the cloud really is, though, a big part of it. I remember Chris Anderson's book, Free,
yep,
which I highly recommend going back and checking out again. I reread a little while ago and had a nice little exchange with him on Twitter. And I think I talked about this on here. The one thing I'll say is he questioned whether or not Facebook was worth as much as like $1 billion or $3 billion. He was skeptical of that. And I think that maybe that probably would have been so when you couldn't understand the full scope of the advertising model that it was going to be embraced. But Chris was fully on board with the idea of what was going to happen to cloud services. And that's such a huge part now of the way we do things. When we pick up our phone and what we do, what's going on behind the scenes, how much is not done on the phone and how much is done there, you know, besides just, you know, storing your photos and things like this. So many of the things when you open up an app and you log in, everything's being handled on some cloud service, not even a central server. So much of that just being run behind the scenes in no place you can specifically point at and say, oh, here's our location facility where this is run from. It's going to be AWS services or Google Firebase doing authentication. So I think that's a big story. And the price is like you can start these things for nothing. You can start these services for next to nothing. And then as they build up, it costs. But we are certainly seeing that the invisible hand affecting pricing for things that don't cost much.
That is a huge thing, is just also not only in terms of how we interact with stuff, but also in the bottom lines of all these businesses, is that cloud computing, AWS, Azure, everybody who got into that game in the aughts, really, and even like Microsoft that really went hard into it during the tens, they fully realized that they were selling cement in the 50s. Like yeah. they are selling the base ingredient for anything that you would want to do, be it a road, a residential home, or a skyscraper. Like everybody needs to get this digital good to build whatever they want.
Yeah. And I think the lesson too was that disruptors can come from anywhere. That, you know, we watched Dropbox became a big company, even though the threat was always, oh, Google's going to do this, Google's going to do this. And we realized that big companies can't do everything really well. And just like recording companies, you know, as far as picking who's going to be a star, you know, I mentioned Billie Eilish before, you've got Post Malone. You know, this is a guy who learned how to play music on playing Rock Band and, you know, is a superstar, you know, and that's the amazing thing to me. And not because somebody saw him playing in some club in Texas and said, oh, I'm going to make you a star, kid. SoundCloud releasing stuff. It was fan made, fan delivered. And that's the most wonderful thing I think about this decade.
I mean,
so many of our stars weren't made stars by gatekeepers. They were people like you guys, you know, who put stuff out there, kept putting it out there, and the fans chose you.
Well, and really there is the saddest story to tell in that for this decade was the fact that you had this gigantic boom of SoundCloud rappers and many of which died at 21. It was fairly reminiscent of, you know, the 90s when you had all the heroin overdoses and grunge, where this like the explosion of a genre dovetailed with the a bunch of younger people kind of getting maybe more money and more exposure. Now in the 90s, obviously that is complicit on some level with the studio system and all the labels and everything and people trying to compete to stay up with where they were going to be. And certainly that plays a part here, but you know, the fact that you've seen so many of those guys either die of, you know, an overdose or gang violence or something like that is really, really disheartening. But it, to me, is the defining sound of the decade. The even pop music sounds like SoundCloud rap now.
Mm-hmm. It's, I think we're going to get more of that, more. I still try to wrap my head around, like, you know, you get people like, you know, Ninja and some of these other people who are, I'm barely aware of, but within their own culture are just giants, you know, and the power of that, you know, and you flip through on Netflix and you'll see, like, you know, Kevin Hart talking to him and the crossover between these self-made people and kind of traditional stars.
Yeah. And now it'll be very interesting to see where some of that goes, because to Brian's point about the monoculture kind of re-emerging, you are certainly seeing at least power players that are spending monoculture money on the talent, and they're spreading it all around. And you know, obviously, Ninja went to Microsoft's streaming platform for an exclusive deal for a lot of money with like a 2-year exclusivity agreement, which is insane. You're seeing that with YouTube. You're seeing that with Facebook to another degree. And it's amazing just to see the kind of cash that is getting thrown around there.
Yeah, I'll throw in it. And I think that part of what's happening is that, and to Brian's point about monoculture maybe making sort of a comeback, is because as it's much more responsive, you know, where it's the ones that kind of hit are the ones that kind of hit that four quadrant or whatever. And it's harder for, like, if you're NBC to say, we're going to make a thing that everybody's going to talk about, it's much harder to do that. But you do see the sort of organic things coming up. And how many times has somebody mentioned to me, hey, did you see the guest on Jimmy Kimmel or Colbert or whatever the other night? Did you hear this? Zero times in the last year has anybody said this to me. Did you see so-and-so on there? The number of times I hear per week, hey, Joe Rogan, do you hear what Joe Rogan had this guy? Joe Rogan had this person on there. And that might be the bubble I'm in, but...
Oh, no. I mean, Joe Rogan is legitimately the loudest voice of 2019 on podcasting, full stop. You know, if people are listening to something in their ears, there's a decent chance that either it's Joe Rogan or somebody about to be on Joe Rogan.
Well, yeah. I mean, dude, that talk about... Rogan might be actually the man of the tens. If anybody who would say, no, the guy from Fear Factor, no, wait, the guy from News Radio was going to be the male Oprah and have that level of impact is insane. And what's fascinating is that he really is, especially in this specific Democratic primary, he is a gatekeeper for political relevance. The campaign of Andrew Yang was almost entirely launched by his Joe Rogan interview. Similar with Bernie Sanders re-emerging and running again. Obviously, he was already a known quantity from 2016, but everybody goes and does it. And it'll be curious to see who goes and does it by the end of this election cycle.
Yeah, I don't really want to get into so much in this, but man, there was that a very critical article. Was it in?
Oh, I believe it was Slate or Salon or whatever. That it was just a hit piece on Rogan that I found it was very bizarre. It left a very bad taste in my mouth. It seemed
insane. I would expect more of Slate than to do some kind of clickbait. The thing you like is really bad. So out of character.
Of course. I mean, they're not the Slate and Salon. There's degrees of difference there. But yeah, it was Slate. But I guess my thing was, like, I'm not, like, I wouldn't call myself a fan of. I don't think I've ever listened to the whole broadcast or whatever. But you know, the sort of the idea define them, like, it's this sort of right wing thing. Maybe, I mean, sure, maybe. But like, as you pointed out, like, I've had more people have come to me and said, oh, you know, you had Bernie Sanders on, and Bernie Sanders, you know, did a really good job of communicating, da da da, you know, or Yang or da da. And I said, yeah, I think that's the strength of it, is that I have people say, oh yeah, I liked hearing those people talk on the show, and not because, oh, the tear down they did on. No, it was just this, like, oh, once you just sort of take them away from the podium and let these people talk and be real people, then they're more interesting. And so I thought, that was when I read the article. I'm like, you know, this is not my takeaway from this. But
yeah, as it turns out, and this is why I do think, the more we talk about it, the more I definitely think that Rogan is somebody that you should think about in terms of a zeitgeist definition of this decade, is that you never really know where that center point is going to be. The person whose point of view is going to resonate with the most amount of people. And the reason why I like comparing him to Oprah is that Oprah existed in this time where being the black friend to a predominantly a white female audience that was smart and funny, but also had these incisive interviews where you were sure that she was going to get a little bit more out of it, but wasn't as tawdry as a Jerry Springer or anything like that. She was that for an age, and obviously still is super powerful. For Joe Rogan, apparently the 2010s was the stoner MMA guy, right? Yeah. who's more intellectual than you might think, but more curious than he is interested in bragging about how smart he is, and just kind of wants to sit there and ask questions, and also isn't afraid to be stupid. I don't think that it's I think that it is part of his origin story that the things that we were talking about Joe Rogan 10 years ago were about, oh, he's a moon landing denialist, right? And it wasn't necessarily because you thought that he was going to lead as it turned out, he didn't lead, you know, a march on Washington to demand that they release the moon landing hoax tapes. He was just a stoner MMA guy who was like, I don't know, man, it seems possible. I've seen a lot of these sets. They look like stuff. And then talks to people and has these conversations and then comes out saying, yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess we definitely landed on there then, and then moved on. And that is a fascinating element of our, every bit of information is in the cloud and we can always find it. It's just a matter of whether or not you want to take the steps.
I am specifically really fascinated by the fact that he basically was doing the same thing for almost a decade. And then just in the last year and a half, his stuff super exploded. And I don't know if that's a matter of behind the scenes, they got better at booking, or if they codified sort of the exact nature of his ability to, in a Howard Stern like manner, get people to open up and have them start, you know, talking in a way that they don't get the opportunity to do. I've heard various incarnations of this word, but they talk about podcasting in general and a few people specifically as being part of like an intellectual dark web, where the idea is like you can just say things differently and express ideas over 2 hours that you cannot put into a tweet. There's no physical way to convey the idea in a tweet that makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, and he's not a gotcha interviewer, and I respect that whole, hey, I don't know, and then like his opinions changing on stuff or whatever, where we live in an age where, you know, people double down on a thing, and then, you know, we've seen that political stuff, that things that we thought were true and pundits sort of doubling down and insisting on this to the point that, you know, you realize that, man, they're never going to admit they're wrong, you know, and which there's certainly a value to that in some spaces, but also not morally. But, you know, here a guy like, yeah, no, tell him, oh, okay, now. And then the next podcast guest changes his mind on something else. I mean, there's something genuine about that, I guess.
Yeah. And to your point, Brian, granted, I'm not a listener to Joe Rogan. So if people are hardcore listeners, want to tell us how the episodes have evolved, I tend to think that it's really just the tide receded to the point where all of a sudden he's this massive influencer. You know, if you look around, where else are you going to find somebody like this? I don't know if anybody had that same idea that he did. I mean, certainly Marc Maron had a version of that for stand-up comedians and then eventually branching out into, you know, a lot of other people. But I think his heart was always in acting. He would rather win an Academy Award than be Oprah. And Joe Rogan's like, no, I'll take this gig, and then I'll also, you know, just interview people who just got knocked out in an MMA ring. That's going to be my gig.
I am really surprised looking at how many names I recognize from, you know, current list of top podcasts that were also there in the very early days of emerging podcasts. And some of them are old media folks that you would expect. Others of them are, you know, kind of quirky newbies in 2009 that here in 2019 are now powerhouses.
Yeah. We've certainly seen a lot more of traditional media making its way into podcasting, because it's kind of become
you know, it's internet radio and whatnot. And we see that, but, you know, I remember years ago, like when watching the back in the Twit days, you know, one of Leo's concerns was that, like, hey, we have this thing called podcasting. It's ours. We don't really, and I'm paraphrasing, I apologize, but based like the fear of big media coming into it and then sort of we would lose this thing, where I kind of think that, like, I think this thing exists because there's things that big media just can't do or won't do or doesn't understand or is too slow to do. And there's going to be a world where there's all these things. And I think that's where we are now. We're in a world where we have all the things. You have, you know, NBC Universal producing podcasts, and then you have some guy in their basement, you know, or whatever, producing stuff that's ranking right up there. And, you know, it's such a level playing field. So, you know, anybody could have a chance at all with your support.
Yeah, man. Look, anybody can have a chance. Thanks. Oh, you know how I define the 2010s is the launch of patreon.com/weirdthings. Head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. Keep us live and independent. Just a buck an episode. If you enjoy us talking about weird things, we'd like to keep on talking about weird things. One way to keep us talking about weird things is to pay us to talk about weird things. So head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. Sign up. Just a buck an episode.
Yeah. All right. Do we want to do predictions for the next decade?
Oh, man. Dude, I mean, why not? It's not like we're ever held to account on any of these.
No.
Boy, you know what? Predictions get a lot tamer as you get older and have a bigger perspective. You know, creeping up on getting ever so close to half a century here. And all of a sudden, I'm like, I don't know, a new iPhone will be slightly faster than the old iPhone. A new 18-year-old will become the hit singer, songwriter, lyricist.
Well, that's the sun to come out tomorrow kind of predictions. Like, yeah, sure, but let's be bold. Let's be brave.
What would we not expect? I'm trying to think of anything.
Do you? I've got one.
Yeah.
To get us started, and I don't know if this is if it's too already in the teens or not. But I know I got an Apple Watch for Christmas, and it feels like with tech and fitness and health stuff, I think that'll continue to blossom into this larger and larger ecosystem. I feel like wearables will be. I mean, I've got NFC chips in my house. That you can do all sorts of automation on these devices.
Well, you know what? Actually, here's a bold prediction, and it's you just inspired me. Okay. In 2020, there will be a data dump and a succession of news articles about maladies that almost certainly X, Y, or Z famous person has due to, like, looking at these sleep rhythms, looking at these this heart rate, looking at this whatever, I can confidently say as an armchair person reading this data dump leak that Greg Grunberg has diabetes or whatever.
Nobody tell Greg.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean,
that is an interesting that's an interesting idea. That the next, you know, like leak of nudes or something like that comes off a cloud because a password is hacked, that could be, oh, that this person has high blood pressure and might have a heart attack, just as much as it's going to be, you know, naked pictures sent from one person to another.
Yeah. In fact, I would say as a larger trend, that's what we're going to be more scared of than the idea of somebody's getting a picture of our genitals.
Well, and I mean, we even see some of this where, you know, Facebook is starting to roll out some of their own healthcare tools and services. I saw an interesting thing.
Nothing to worry about.
Well, and I saw an interesting thing about this on Twitter today, that if you give Facebook your health data, that data is not protected under, say, HIPAA.
Oh my God.
I don't even know why you would tell Facebook that you had a blood pressure test or a pap smear, but you can.
How innocuous would it seem to, like, oh, test your blood pressure. Thanks. Now I know your blood pressure. That's some pretty heavy duty stuff. You get a few data points on that, you can tell an awful lot.
Think about this. This Facebook is also doing dating.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh my God. So, yeah. so now all of a sudden you get a nefarious app that says, hey, we noticed that you just entered a relationship with so-and-so. We have vital medical information about so-and-so that you could pay $20 to unlock and we will give it to you. Oh,
beyond that, just guiding, sending people to different people with different health.
Yeah.
Eugenics.xyz. Like, who knows what why these two services on the same company could integrate in.
I had a very creepy experience where, like, I have a eczema, right? And so I did a search on that. And I never, because I was looking up some other treatment or something like this. And so I did a search on that. And then I click over to another web page. And of course, the ad network thing came into play. It was a news site. I've never had this happen before. A complete full screen, full page pop up for some like skin drug pops up.
Oh,
right?
Jesus.
Covers the whole page. I can't even find the thing to click it to close it because it's there somewhere, but it's like a full page thing took over. I'd never seen anything like that. And I'm like, man, this must be an expensive drug because what they're paying for this site to do that is huge. And that was creepy. It was like the Google search bar, which I'm going to go type this thing into search. And of course, boom, you know, you click on a link and now they know you're looking at this stuff. That was just weird. It was like the full page ad.
It is. Maybe that's the biggest change from 2010 to 2020 is at the beginning of 2010, going into incognito mode was to surf pornography. Now 2020, going into incognito mode means I'm about to ask about some medical conditions because I do not want all that targeted stuff.
I do go into incognito mode when I want to type in stupid questions. Yeah. I don't want Google to know.
Duck, go in incognito, man.
I don't want Google to know. I don't know what a suitcase is.
All right, so here's my prediction. Offline computing.
Oh.
I think that we will see a new and bigger resurgence in think of a Amazon Echo that, you know, has enough computing power and enough data about your home, but is not connected to the internet. And can do certain things.
Oh, that's interesting. So like the regular Amazon Echo might be 30, 50 bucks home. Or whatever, but then there's a $300 or $400 or $500 version that it's like no need to. Yeah, but even then, I don't know that I'd trust it. That would be really
because you have to imagine it would have to get updates from Amazon.
Yeah. I think this is something where you can do private things and maybe. Every once in a while, there is a supervised connection to some kind of like a internet thing so it can get relevant data, but it comes in carts, you know, that you plug into it. But there is no connection. It can't spit anything back out to the web.
I could see something like that. If voice recognition, if there becomes an open enough voice recognition thing that they can load into an offline device and you just do it for offline stuff like timers or home automation. I bet we could see something like that in the next because 5 years.
There are a few right now. There's Mycroft.ai, which is an open source version of a virtual assistant. And then there's some other services and stuff they're trying to do. And there's been some Kickstarters for like completely like Raspberry Pi based, you know, stuff.
So yeah, my big prediction is I think that we see some of the bigger companies, even the companies that sell money on sell ads, we'll see that there is as we become more distrustful of being followed around, which again, a decade ago, we all knew was happening, but apparently everybody figured it out in the intervening 10 years. that will become something that people want more, that will be exciting, that they want to do certain kinds of searches and certain kinds of computations on something that does not feedback out.
I completely understand why you would make that prediction, but I suspect that there's just a generation of kids growing up without any expectation of privacy. And I suspect that it's humans that will change faster that rather than request that the tech change to them.
Well, maybe think about it from more from like a corporate point of view, where let's say, you know, you're going to get to a point where Amazon's going to offer, you know, Chipotle, like their own voice assistant tech to be used in the kitchens or employees or whatever. And you're going to get companies to say, yes, we want these services, but we need to know that they're secure and they're private and whatever, and it's our own. We want to have our own AI systems that we're doing that. And I could see from a company point of view where it would be beneficial where you to do that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and Brian, don't think of it as a Luddite thing. Think of it as a technological progression. That now that there is the technological computing ability, and there are the neural networks that can create a home device that is powerful enough to make it worth your while.
Yeah, and I guess that becomes sort of like, once you have the means to afford that, all things being equal, why wouldn't you spend a few $100 to have like an AI bot sort of like, hey, I'm going to create an account for you. It'll be a clean account on Google. For every time you Google search for diabetes, I'm also going to search for 75 other maladies. That way Google won't know which of these are the ones that you're really afraid of. So basically a middling agent to anonymize everything.
But, you know, that's also what Apple does with their when you use their services, is that they do these sort of like anonymized. That's one of the things they try to anonymize data is by doing a bunch of spurious sort of other queries and stuff.
And also, Brian, you are always the guy who is you know, looking to the bright gleaming star above of the AI that just tells you what to do, that knows you better than you know yourself, that knows your family better than they know themselves, and can make the little recommendation that changes everything before anything else happens. This is where I think we're going with the offline computing, is that once, like, so let's just take a look at, like, okay, well, when your doors open and close, when your kids come and go, when the stuff goes rotten, there are certain elements to that in our world now that we look at as like, this is something that I'm going to think twice about bringing that into my home. And you're right, maybe we'll get to the point where we don't care about that anymore, but maybe you can say, all right, look, the idea of an AI being very aggressive about how you can deal with your life better that isn't connected to the internet might eventually be more, you might be willing to turn a few more dials and experiment a little bit more about something that knows everything about you, that knows when you tossed and turned in a way that doesn't require a thing, that you can just put a little pad under your mattress and it will know every little element and will be able to be more personal. Because I guess that's where I think we're going to the her world. We're going to the world where the AI is going to be very personal to us. And so my thought experiment is that some of that will be eased along by not being connected to the internet.
Yeah, I'm very on board with the sentiment. I just feel like it'll still be connected to the internet, but there'll be some payment structure that makes it make sense to act as a firewall, to act as the go-between between us and the internet. I think we're in the same neighborhood. I think we're both describing the same human impetus, but I suspect it'll be very connected to the internet, just in a way that we trust to obfuscate our private life.
So I on that line, like, I'm making on my little list of predictions here, and I think AI will be weird and annoying. You know, we saw that with that. Remember, Google did that voice call where they called the restaurant and had the AI like, hello, we want to find out what time you're closed. And they didn't quite realize they're talking to a person. And some people are like, hey, that's really weird and maybe invasive. And other people are like, hey, it's the future, get with it. We're going to see more of that. You know, AI robocallers, all that sort of stuff. You know, and then the dark use of the tech is going to be really, really good phishing, you know, attempts and stuff like this that, because it's going to say, oh, you know, I know Brian on Twitter, and it's going to fake an email from Brian to me that's going to read exactly like a Brian email, because an AI could generate a lot of these. And we talked about, you know, the way deep fakes, things like this, all of that, that's going to make us very unsure of who we're talking to, which could create the need for like firewalls and stuff like really intelligent AI systems to say like, hey, there are five things wrong with this. I don't think this is Brian. You know, there's several things going on here, you know, raise the alarm.
Just a quick side jag, man, am I really impressed at, in a world where 2019 saw 4 of my credit cards compromised at various times, it very quickly became not even a thing. Like, they're getting so, there have been a few minor inconveniences where I wanted to pay with something and I had to call a number and say, hey, are you really trying to buy that? Yeah, I am. Okay, great. But like, man, they are investing a lot to stay one step ahead because, of course, credit cards, by the way, if anybody steals your credit card, if anybody spends your money, and no matter how much it is, you are not liable for any of it. Credit card companies know this. They understand that it's better and cheaper for them to invest in the statistical analysis to figure out in what looks like people testing out credit card numbers that may or may not be compromised. It's remarkable how weirdly it's much, much safer today than it was 10 years ago, which doesn't really think about that.
That's a good point. You have that Apple card, and that's like, I don't even think about it now because it's just, you know, the way you can generate the new credit card numbers and stuff, and every transaction shows up on the phone, which is, I think we'll see more of that, like communications and stuff. On the other sense, like, I think AI content, I think that we're going to see, we're watching, like, the one of the amazing things about Mandalorian to me is the big VFX thing. So much of the VFX we saw were done because of Unreal Engine. You know, a video game, basic video game engine is used to drive the environments and stuff we see. And, you know, that crossover of that tech is kind of fascinating. And we're going to see, I think, a lot more of that, more, you know, we might find, like, you know, Rise of Skywalker brought back Carrie Fisher, and I thought that it, I think they're using sort of old school tech to do that stuff for what some of the scenes they've tried to do it, and not sort of the newer generation stuff. But I think when we start seeing the newer generation stuff, we're going to find out, like, oh yeah, no, this whole scene was all, we just had an AI put the two actors there and we add the voices to it. You know, we're going to see more and more of that coming up. And maybe, you know, we'll start feeding something Last Airbender cartoons and stuff, and now we can just give it a script and the AI can produce it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. That didn't seem like a crazy thing to say.
I know.
That's the funny thing.
No. I know.
I mean,
yeah.
Especially when you look at where we came from with CGI.
Yeah.
I think that there's going to be a lot of verbiage that we used at the beginning of this decade of being excited. Oh God, I hate it when too much CGI, it looks like garbage. Like that was a thing that was said a lot at the beginning of the decade, now said a lot less. And I think that will continue to evolve. Obviously there will always be people who make things that look not great. Right. But I think I'm with you, Andrew, that the scope of how we use these things will continue to mushroom.
Yeah. And that's, I guess, the hard part. It's hard to figure out something to say that's going to be crazy, you know. I think this decade, VR for real, and VR drugs.
VR drugs? Do you mean drugs that enhance your VR experience?
Got any?
That was actually one of my favorite ideas in the, I don't know if it was in the book version, but in the movie version of Minority Report. You know, obviously the main character, sort of, you know, pining for his lost child, is watching essentially immersive home movies under the influence of a drug that really makes him feel like he's there. That, man, if you're holding, then, you know, we could teleport over. We can make this happen. Well,
there's that thing that happens when we dream, that some part of our brain sort of suspends disbelief, you know, and takes the most abstract sort of thing and accepts it's real. Like you're in a car. There are no door handles. There's nothing to it. It's just the idea of a car, and your brain's like, yeah, I'm in a car. No reason to question this. You know, somebody starts to package that, put that in a drug, and you strap on your Oculus Quest 2.0.
For just one brief moment. So yeah, and of course with dreams, what happens is number one, there's a paralytic drug that your brain releases so that you don't actually get up and run around and do stuff. And then at some level it suppresses the urge to question what's going on. You just roll with everything. But then there's that, this is why having a dream journal works, is because the moment you wake up, your brain goes to work saying, okay, it's not helpful to have all of these conflicting memories. Let me scrub all of this. And that's why if you have a dream journal and you write it down in that brief foggy 30 seconds after you wake up, then you won't remember the actual dream, but you will remember the process of remembering it as you write it down, which is very close to that. So the idea that you could get the immersion of a dream and yet have that as a fantasy memory that continues to live in your mind, that would be amazing.
We know that the other thing about the dream thing is it's and I'm sure you're giving sort of the thumbnail, but like it doesn't even erase the dream. It just sort of kind of like old school just erases the top of the directory. Because how many times have you had it where you're driving along or something, all of a sudden you remember vividly some environment or some place in a dream you probably had like 7 years before?
Sure. And in fact, many people have had the experience of deja vu. I think I've always had it slightly differently, because when I have a deja vu, it's never that this has happened before. It's always under the framework of me believing, no, I had this dream. And then I try to remember what happened next. And of course, I never get it right. But yeah, man, those are going to be really good drugs.
Yeah. We can next week. We'll talk about a new quantum worlds theory called MIW, multiple interacting worlds, instead of just multiple worlds theory. The idea of multiple interacting worlds.
So multiple worlds theory is the idea that anything that has a non-zero chance, there's a splinter of reality that goes that way. But in that version, it's forever splintering and they're all independent threads. This one, there's actually interaction.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll say that.
Many worlds interacting. Sorry.
Hey, yeah, I have a totally unrelated pick for this episode.
What's that?
Did you guys watch the season finale, the series finale of Mr. Robot?
Yes.
Nope.
What'd you think?
I liked it a lot. It was a softer landing than I expected. And I wanted to be moved to tears, and I wasn't. They didn't really aim for that, though, you know.
Yeah.
But they did deliver just one more gut-punching surprise. And the longer I sat with it, the more I liked it. And the more I liked there's sort of what I believe is a bit of an iconic kind of end scene. And I liked that, you know, from the first scene of episode one, he directly addresses the audience. And as they wrap everything up, I like the fact that I felt like I had a place in that scene as the audience member. And I liked it a lot.
Yeah, we talked a lot about it on the last Spoiler in Time for Cord Killers, the penultimate episode of Mr. Robot. And I was hesitant about it because there are a lot of different ways it could have gone. And I really, really dig the way that it resolved everything. It was not my first choice of the stupid stuff I would have loved to see them do. But I think it was very sweet. I was just watching it, and I also didn't cry, but I could feel it right in my chest of just like, you know, how substantial it feels for
four
seasons.
There are a lot of shows that I've given up on because I've been afraid that they're not going to stick the landing. And if whoever hears these words was like that with Mr. Robot, number one, I'm going to say that I watched it week after week. And so there's a few things that, you know, you forget from season one that tie into season four. And, you know, all things being equal, it probably flows even better if you binge the whole thing. And it definitely sticks the landing. I would say I won't know what it's like to sit down and just start it today and go through all four seasons, but I bet it's pretty epic and great. I bet it's a fantastic experience.
We should talk off the stream about a scene in the finale that I did not recognize. And when I was...
There was a reference to another thing?
More than that.
Okay.
More than that, man.
Like literally footage from the other thing? Okay. All right. It's a great show.
Most of it is on Amazon Prime right now.
Hey, I watched The Witcher.
Oh, what'd you think?
It's on Netflix. I ain't never played these video games. I ain't never read these books. I don't know if I would vouch for it in terms of writing quality, but it is a fire hose of fantasy. Like, it is an unrelenting stream of fantasy. And the thing that I liked about it was it's at least not, if it's gonna be balls out weird fantasy, it's at least not boring. That there were episodes where I'm like, oh, this is the fantasy thing where they, you know, the
Cheap Chop comes over here, and then they find the talisman, and there's another talisman, and then they, you know, eventually go under a magic waterfall. And it's constantly kind of like shifting and evolving. And yes, it is, if you're frustrated by fantasy writing where there's always an incantation and there's always another rule that is older magic than the old magic that you thought you were working toward, it certainly has plenty of that. But I will say that it was smarter than I thought it was going to be. And that is something that I enjoy in a show like that. It's certainly not the tactician or politician dreams of Game of Thrones. It is far more Beastmaster than Game of Thrones.
Go on.
And you have my attention, sir.
And it feels like something that's speed running a fantasy book. Like, you know, at a certain point you're like, oh, okay, this is,
because it's like a monster of the week sort of thing. It's not all serialized arcs, right? That's what I've heard.
There's a lot of, I almost hesitate to say it, but if it will get people interested, there's a lot of skipping. Like, you might think that, and that's part of what I enjoyed about it, was just when you kind of think you know what this character is going to do, there's a lot of time skipping around. And, you know, for some holiday binge watching, I thought it was pretty good. And also, man, Henry Cavill, you know, a very likable actor. I think this is a great role for him. He is obviously enough of the heavy to be the big, you know, studly action star, but you like him enough that you're not bored by just watching him hack through somebody else.
Over the holiday, my parents asked that I buy them Disney Plus so that the grandkids could watch.
By which they meant buy yourself Disney Plus and give them the password.
They gave me $100 in cash. Just to,
that's how you do it. Brilliant.
So I, you know, Disney Plus has got so much stuff on it. It's got that big catalog, all these new originals, you know, shorts and cartoons and stuff. And so my pick for this week is The Simpsons. The only thing I could find on Disney Plus that I wanted to watch.
Oh no!
Simpsons, eh?
I do want to watch The Mandalorian, I guess. But you know, talking about.
Okay, first of all, okay. You didn't even give a try to The World According to Jeff Goldblum.
We as a family did, and it was very surface level. It was like the first episode is about sneakers, and it's like, sneakers aren't that, isn't that what they wear in the basketball court?
Keep doing your very best Jeff Goldblum impression. And for me, it will be like a sequel to Thor Ragnarok. Just keep going.
No, these sneakers, these, how much do they, $500. No, wow. It was a lot of that.
My favorite review of Jeff Goldblum explains everything, or whatever it's called, is that in that pilot episode, he's shocked by the concept of shoes.
Yeah. Like,
he's just mystified that laces exist, like as if he was just like dropped from Mars. And he's just like, wow, what? Little strings through the shoes? Oh.
And it was a lot of that, and so I think we'd put it on, and everybody left the room while it was on.
Ah!
It didn't
come back.
Little known fact: Earth Girls Are Easy was a documentary about how Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah. but hey, man, The Simpsons. They still haven't solved that like widescreen issue where they've cropped them all.
Yeah, because they're cutting out like gag jokes. There was one where the joke was they're touring the Duff Beer Factory and there's giant vats of Duff Dry, Duff Light, Duff Regular, whatever. And then
it cuts it out so you don't see that they're all from the same pipe.
Yeah,
and that was actually one of the episodes I ended up watching the past few days. I was like, oh yeah, that just doesn't look, that's nothing if you don't see that right. They've said that they're gonna fix those, but I think, like,
which, hey, by the way there was no way that was getting fixed before the end of the Mandalorian run, because Disney is definitely gonna get at least a day with the Simpsons fans where it's hey, if you haven't signed up for Disney Plus yet, like, here we go, let's get those sub numbers up.
And I don't know, it's weird because you can tell it's an HD transfer of at least the old ones of the cells, because it looks really sharp. But also there was a scene, I had paused it and I came back to it a little while later, and it was some shot of the family TV, and it was like 4x3. It looked like it was right, and it made me think, oh, did it just switch over? But it was just that one shot. It was, for some reason, just that one shot. So whenever they did, and might have been FX that did this, because FX had The Simpsons before Disney Plus. There's some weird conversion thing that happened.
Here's what I suspect is, at first, just get it on there. Let us say the letters HD with it. And I think Justin's right. Then when there's a gap in the schedule, let's make a thing of doing it. And you can...
Because FX had this exact same issue. When it was on FX Plus or the FX app, they were all in this widescreen conversion, and then they eventually switched over to 4:3.
Once a human is able to touch every bit of this, you can actually get something really delightful out of it. I remember the same thing happened with The Wire. Was it David Simon? So who did the Wire?
Yeah.
David Simon was writing about how some scenes it made sense to punch in, other scenes it made sense to just let it be wider. And one of the last scenes of season two, where you see all of the dock workers, originally it was framed 4x3. It looked like there was a bazillion of them because it was all cut off, but he realized it was a more poignant message when you expanded it to 16x9, because you saw that while they were gathered very closely, they weren't that many. And so they were a crowd, but they were a lonely crowd. And so, you know, once you have a person doing things on purpose, I think everything gets all smoothed out.
Yeah. We're still in a very weird time of taking SD to HD conversions. I mean, there was a thing a few years ago about Malcolm in the Middle going HD and widescreen on Netflix, but it was not cut for 4x3. So you could see things like stand-ins of the kids in the additional size.
Oh, that's great.
You know, stuff like that. But hey, you know what? The Simpsons still really holds up. A lot of physical comedy style comedy in an animated show still really holds up.
My favorite of one of those when they re-released was the original Star Trek, the motion picture, where they did the extended edition. And there's sequences where, like, when Spock comes out of the Star Enterprise, they do this wide, and it's an unfinished mat shot. You just literally see part of the hole and you see the rest of, like, the sound studio. But because it looked techie or spacey or something, because it was like girders and stuff, they left it in. But you're like, man, like, anybody watch this? First, I'm not a pick. I'm going to show you. I got the best Christmas present possible. Oh. I don't want to brag. I don't want to make anybody jealous. My girlfriend gave me this.
Forgive my laughter.
Oh, my gosh. I have a condition.
Oh,
moron back.
Oh, my God. That's funny.
That's so great.
Yes. I got the Joker card. So damn straight I'm gonna keep this and use this. Probably I restrained from using this in the line at the airport, you know, for the TSA. And hand them the card. That would have kept me from getting on there. Oh yes. And I got she got me this
coffee mug.
It's the Elon Musk
the tweet. I'm considering
you have a miss. Yeah, I'm considering taking Tesla private at 420, funding secured, which, by the way, in the news, because Tesla hit 420 last week.
Yep. It hit a high this year of 435. So it's currently below 420. So, but anyhow, that was pretty funny. But my pick is this, man. There have been some shows have come out that haven't got as much attention as other stuff. I think I mentioned before Castle Rock season 2. I really enjoy Castle Rock. If you like anthology, you like horror, love dark stuff, highly recommend Castle Rock, but that's not what I'm here to pick. I'm halfway through this so far, and this has been delightful. Anybody else here watch The Terror season 1?
No.
So The Terror is the fictionalized account of the ships, the HMS Terror and the Erebus, which were two ships that were sent off by the British government to try to find a Northwest Passage in the 1800s. They were the most technologically advanced ships of their day. They had, you know, like diving suits to fix things like propellers. They're part steam-powered, part sail-powered. They were the most well-equipped. It was like kind of like the NASA of its day. They went up in the North Passage and winter came. And it's hard to predict what's going to happen with the water and the ice, but they got iced in. So all of a sudden, what was the wide open ocean became solid ice, and these ships were stuck for over 2 years, and we did not know what happened to them until quite recently. So it was one of the big mysteries of what happened to the ships. So literally like 2 years ago or something, I think we found the wreckage or some remnants of that. But they take that account of these two ships, these two, you know, the pride of the Navy of the day, and tell a story about this, a horror story involving, you know, elements of, you know, I guess you would say Inuit legend stuff, not like that, whatever. Really, really enjoying it. Really enjoying it. So The Terror on Hulu.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. I guess that's it. I guess.
Happy 2020.
Yeah. Bye, tens.
Yeah.
Eat my farts, loser.
Beginning that's of a new decade. Come at me if you think that it's not the end of the decade.
I just had a dark thought. I'm like, God, man, think about doing this for 10 years from now. And I'm like, I hope we're all here.
Oh, jeez. All right. You know what? I'm going to say it. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.